Read what you enjoy, not what bores you, is the credo of Nick Hornby, who discusses books he enjoys in his Stuff I've Been Reading columns in The Believer magazine. 18 months of those columns from 2010 and 2011 have been collected in a book called More Baths, Less Talking, published by McSweeney's. Mr. Hornby is the author of 6 novels, a memoir, a book of music criticism, 3 other collections, a book reviews, and the Oscar-nominated screenplay for An Education. I'm very pleased that his latest work brings him back to our show. It's good to see you again.
Thanks for having me back.
Each column begins with a list of books bought and books read. Why is it that these lists don't generally overlap?
This seems to be something that strikes a chord with everybody, actually, that we browse in bookshops and we like the look of what we see and we take it home, but then something happens in our reading journey that means that those books are no longer quite what we had in mind.
So does it end even before you start reading a book, or do you have to read at least 10 pages before you decide you don't want to go on any further?
It's usually nothing to do with the quality of the book. It's to do with some sense of, I don't know what you'd call it, intellectual appetite, that I was in the mood for that when I was in the bookstore, and I'm not in the mood for it a week later when I finish the book that I'm reading.
Do you rely on other people's reviews? For example, when The Economist praises a book or the Financial Times, are you more likely to pick it up for yourself?
If it's something that I haven't heard about, I remember there was a book in here, Emily Fox Gordon's essays, that I don't think I would have come across if I hadn't read a review in The Economist. I tend not to read the books, looking at it now, I tend not to read the books that everybody seems to be reading. I don't want to be part of that particular conversation. I think it's a private journey for me.
So you don't tend to read many books that get nominated for the Man Booker?
I haven't read any of this year's, no, or probably last year's either.
Have you ever read Hilary Mantel?
I have read Hilary Mantel. I haven't read the 2 big historical novels.
Do you think you can spot a book that you'll probably enjoy even before you start reading it? Will the cover, I know they say you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a book by its cover, at least the way a publisher feels about a book.
Absolutely. And sometimes it's a blurb from an author I particularly admire that's on the front, and you think, well, that guy doesn't give many blurbs, so that's interesting. Title, some suggestion of wit in the content. There are all sorts of things, I think, that can tip you over.
Do you think that the books you've reviewed favorably in these columns will continue to attract readers in the years to come? Because there are books that become immediate sensations and then tend to disappear, while others continue on and on and sometimes even become classics.
Yes, and I'm not sure that we have any way of knowing what's going to survive and what isn't. And it's a subject that actually interests me, especially reading Dickens' biography, which is the last review in this book. It was quite clear at the time that Dickens was not really regarded as somebody who was going to last or was even interested in lasting.
In this country, Melville, one of our greatest writers, was totally disrespected during most of his lifetime. But you say that some books, like The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, which was a really big hit, a major bestseller, often turn out to be disappointments.
Well, I think that there are all sorts of reasons why books that spoke to an audience 40 years ago aren't necessarily going to speak to the same audience now. And that there are also books, I think, that it's good not to reread, that sometimes when you're 21 and a book screams at you and you think that every single word is the burning truth and you read it age 45 and you're maybe slightly repelled by it or embarrassed by it.
Well, because you said that also in the case of Jane Brodie, you were disappointed because you read Imitators of it afterwards. It
wasn't her fault. It's an extremely influential book, and lots of people ended up writing like Muriel Spark and also writing about that kind of character.
And you say you generally like Muriel Spark because she writes small. She doesn't write big books. She doesn't write books with a lot of pages.
Well, that was a nice little discovery that I hadn't read her before, and I came across a novel of hers that I didn't know, and it was, they're like 150 pages long, and so I read four or five in very quick succession and loved most of them. A Far Cry from Kensington, I think, is a beautiful book.
So you have a 500-page cutoff? Does that mean that you don't read Proust or Joyce?
I haven't read Joyce's big books. I am the expert on anyone's small book. So I've read the small Pynchon, I've read the small Joyce, I've read the small everybody.
And in the case of Proust, I guess you can read them in the small volumes and not say you're reading the whole
remembrance. Yes.
But your first column begins with a detailed review of a 600-page book called Austerity Britain, 1945-1951. Not exactly an easy read, and definitely over 500 pages.
Yeah, I mean, that guy really justifies the length. I've since read the sequel to that book, which is called Family Britain, and takes the next 6 years. Those books, David Kynaston's Social Histories, really are easy reads. I mean, they don't look it from the outside. I think probably tougher read for an American. But he writes about a country changing and growing month by month, and he brings in culture and he brings in sport and the royal family and politics. And he is the most extraordinary researcher, and the books are a joy to read, but they look incredibly intimidating.
So have you reviewed books that you thought you might not care for and they snuck up on you?
Well, I tend now to be able to pick pretty good books for myself. I don't think that happens too often.
My guest is Nick Hornby, whose latest book is Morbath's List Talking. Why that title?
Well, Morbath's List Talking comes from a book about sex therapy that I read one month. I was doing some research for a script that I was writing, and the woman in there who was writing the book suggested that there are lots more ways of communicating than conversation, and she suggested baths. But of course, it's a pretty good thing for a reader as well, more baths, less talking.
Well, you can also do less talking if you're doing a lot of reading when and the other person is watching television. Is that a good thing? Doesn't reading keep you actually prevent intimacy?
Reading certainly prevents intimacy, and this is one of the great paradoxes, I think, of reading, because if you listen to certain critics, reading is the thing that makes you more human. But, of course, all these people that have read enormous amounts tend to be less human than the rest of us.
And your kids play video games, don't they?
My kids are both boys. The two younger boys both play video games all the time. They could not care less for books, and it's a constant battle. They can read. That's all I can say for them.
And despite the fact that their father's in the business, they are not tempted?
They are not tempted. I mean, I do think they have the role model, because I can promise you they see me lounging around with a book in the house quite a lot. But it doesn't seem to make them think, oh, that looks like a great activity for me.
Well, you just praised a work of nonfiction, but you say you prefer fiction to nonfiction. The trend seems to be in the opposite direction for most readers.
Yes. I think I would rather find a great novel every time. I think those are the things that tend to endure most. But I think what typically happens, especially for men as they get older, is that they seem to not want to waste their time on fiction. They want facts, facts. They're like Mr. Gradgrind in Hard Times.
You say that you see a similarity between your penchant for modern literature and yogurt making.
You'll have to remind me.
Well, it's okay.
I'm sorry I said that. I take it back.
Well, you say you were skeptical of the pre-modern. You didn't like to read classics?
Yes. I think I was one of those kids that was slightly... I never wanted to read what the teachers told me to read. I wanted to find my own path, and I tended to read more contemporary things and something that seemed connected to rock and roll in some way. And as I've got older, I've found I've been able to make the links with rock and roll in more and more unlikely places.
With Jane Austen and
certainly
George Eliot and Dickens?
I mean, Dickens was a part of popular culture. He, you know, he wrote serialized novels for the masses.
Well, you, but at the same time, you said that you didn't particularly like Our Mutual Friend.
I was very surprised when I reread Our Mutual Friend recently, quite how ropey some of it was. It has the most terrible piece of plotting, where Dickens has clearly dug himself into a hole and is choosing the easiest way out of it.
But he was a hack writer in the best sense, and who often was just turning out books chapter by chapter on deadline. Even Dostoevsky, who did that, had some pretty clunker chapters.
Yeah, I think Dickens' commitment to writing and to his family, I mean, he had so many dependents. It was incredible. No kid grew up to do anything that took him off the payroll, and he had an extended family of ex-wives and wives' brothers, and he wrote for money. My previous collection was called Shakespeare Wrote for Money. Well, Dickens really wrote for money, and he was writing sometimes two novels simultaneously.
You say about Huckleberry Finn, which most Americans consider one of the greatest novels ever written in this country, you say, meh.
That was a book that disappointed me on rereading, or didn't speak to me as it had spoken to me when I was 21. I read it at college, and I thought it was incredible. And Tom Sawyer's sort of niggly worldliness really—I know it's proving a point, but it was very tough to read this time.
But he was such a witty writer, wasn't he, Mark Twain?
I think Twain is an incredible writer, and there's nothing not worth reading.
And he also was, like Dickens, was kind of a pop star in his time, and that's something you're interested in. You read a book about Celine Dion. Now, I read a lot of books, but I'm not sure I'd be tempted by that.
I think that two of the books that have really knocked me back over the last 5 years were about definitions of culture. One was Professor John Carey's book, What Good Are the Arts, which is all about the inevitability of cultural relativism, how you actually can't say that Shakespeare was better than anybody. And the other one was this little book about Celine Dion, which does the same thing for the formation of musical taste, that the author wrote an extended essay on Celine Dion, taking the position that he couldn't like her and he would never be able to like her. And by the end of the book, he has deconstructed his own prejudices until he finds that he's kind of in pieces on the floor. It's really a great book. They're republishing it with some essays by other writers. I'm going to write an essay about it.
The New Republic called you one of the best positive critics working today. Is that how you see yourself, as a positive critic? Because in England, it's been my sense that there is something of a style of criticism in which the reviewer tries to say the meanest thing in the wittiest way.
Yep. And I'd say that probably when I started my writing career, I was like that when I was a kid, and I wasn't even a kid. I was old enough to know better, but it's the best way to get yourself noticed. But I've learnt an awful lot from the Believer's policy, the magazine's policy of not wanting writers to say unkind things about other writers. It's sort of changed my life to the extent that I'm way more careful about what I choose to read.
And Joyce Carol Oates, I think, says that she doesn't bother reviewing a book that she doesn't like when there are so many good books to get into and to talk about.
I think that's an entirely sound policy.
After you finish a book, how do you decide what to read next?
Well, there's usually a pile on the bedside table, but it's quite possible that the book I've just finished will throw up something else I want to read.
Well, you read a biography of Lucille Ball and then went on to the next book about a banking crisis.
Yeah, that didn't work so well. Sometimes life is affecting what you want to read. I needed to know something about what was happening.
Well, in some cases, I got a little upset with you. For example, okay. Montaigne is one of my absolute favorite writers. I just think he was the most brilliant modern thinker, especially for someone who lived in a time when the world saw things so differently. You were disappointed.
I find it hard to read the Montaigne essays, yes. I think that...
Do you think it's the translations, or because he doesn't have any sex in them? You say there were no smutty bits.
I found them meandering a bit much sometimes, but I think that... Give me a break. I read a biography of Montaigne, and I absolutely loved it. I think that book is incredible.
Well, the man was lived an extraordinary life.
Yes, yeah.
Aren't you currently adapting Colm Tóibín's Brooklyn for the screen?
Yeah, I've got a couple of adaptation jobs on the go. I've hopefully finished with Brooklyn for a while, and the idea is that that gets made next year with Rooney Mara.
Well, you say that he doesn't care whether we care about his characters. Is that a good or a bad thing? Especially, do you keep that in mind when you're writing a novel?
I want people to care very much. And I want, I think, to write about people that I like, even if they are deeply flawed people.
And that's a problem when you're a screenwriter. If you write a character who is dislikable, in fact, if all your characters are dislikable, in the end, the audience is often turned off.
Yes, but I don't think Colm's like that. I think that he's not a judgmental writer, and he will always find something in them. And that's my job as a screenwriter, is to find something that people can find.
Does having to read and write about books for what you describe as little compensation lessen your enjoyment of them? After all, it's a job, which is different than just opening up a book for the sheer pleasure of reading it.
Well, the beauty of this column is that I only write about what I've read that month. I choose what I read, I choose how much I read, and there have been times over the last 10 years, especially during, for example, World Cup months, when I've read nothing at all, and I'm writing about reading nothing at all. So it doesn't feel like a burden in that way at all.
And you also write, and I wonder about is there a little dialogue between what you're reading and what you're writing?
I think that there's always a dialogue between what you're consuming. So it might be what I'm writing, what I'm watching, what I'm listening to. All of that feeds into what I'm writing, and as well as what you're living through, of course, as well.
Nick Hornby's latest book is a collection of columns that he wrote for The Believer magazine under the heading Stuff I've Been Reading. The book is More Baths, Less Talking. It's published by McSweeney's. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Lynn.